It's March 22nd, 2024, and this is the Room Now podcast. Hi, I'm Dr. Jack Cush, executive editor of RoomNow.com. Each week we get together. It's like getting married every week, is it not? So on this festive occasion, I'm going to give you something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue. You're going to have to figure out what the blue means. Actually, this week I'm going to talk about a few things that I found more different than what I expected, meaning I have these teachings that I'm based on history and fact, I thought, but some of this research I present this week challenges some of those thoughts, and let's see what you think about it. Let's begin with Plaquenil and pregnancy. Now, I don't know if there's any argument here or any concern here, but there is a concern about giving DMARD therapy to women who are pregnant. The teaching clearly is Plaquenil is very safe during pregnancy. We know in lupus that it has tremendous benefits from so many things, and maybe the same can be said for RA. Well, this particular study comes from the Swedish registry databases, which are substantial and really quite accurate. And what they looked at here was the use of hydroxychloroquine in the first trimester. So specifically, they looked at 1,000 lupus births. About half were exposed to hydroxychloroquine, and 2,500 RA births, and they're only 144. So that's actually less than 10% were exposed to hydroxychloroquine. So obviously, in Sweden, they know that it's okay to use it in lupus, but maybe they have some concern about its use in RA. The main readout here was major congenital malformations. And when looking at lupus patients and exposed and unexposed, the rate was roughly 3.5% with no difference. And when looking at RA patients, exposed versus unexposed, you know, the rates were, I think, 4 to 5.5%, no significant difference there. And, you know, it's always hard to know about congenital malformation rates because there's not a lot of great data. But it's often stated that the historic rate in the general population is 3 to 6%. So these numbers reinforce the safety of hydroxychloroquine in our patients who have either RA or lupus and who happen to also become pregnant. I like this study about Sjogren's syndrome. I think I don't cover Sjogren's enough. I think many of you are more concerned about Sjogren's than I am. But these are two large cohorts with over 900 patients. And in their analysis, they classify these patients clinically and somewhat immunologically, and they came up with three groups. And the first group they initialed as BALS. These are patients with high levels of B cell activity, but a low degree of symptoms. Interestingly, in this group, they found that symptoms did progress over time. The second group was an HSA group. They had high systemic activity. And the third group was low systemic activity, but high symptoms. While these groups may make some sort of phenotypic sense, the only thing I saw that out of this report that was useful was the risk of lymphoma seems to be highest in the patients with the BALS group, the high B cell activity group, and the HSA group, the high systemic activity group, where there was a 3 to 4% risk of future lymphoma in Sjogren's. Now, I don't know about you. I've taken care of many, many Sjogren's over the years. It is the most common autoimmune disease if you consider primary and secondary Sjogren's patients. I only have two good cases of lymphoma. And I'm wondering, by looking at this data, have I missed a few? So maybe you need to have a high index of suspicion. I guess maybe you could identify those patients with high systemic features, that's easy to identify. High B cell activity, maybe you get that from hypergammaglobulinemia unless you're going to do specific immunologic testing. A nice series of lupus patients responding to anifrolumab, an antibody that targets type 1 interferons. In this particular report, it's being used and shown to have its utility in patients with chronic lupus skin disease specifically. So it's really a case series, 6 patients, 4 with discoid lupus, 2 with other forms of chronic cutaneous LE, 37 to 66 years old, 10 years disease duration. They all responded clinically, even though that prior to receiving anifrolumab, they had failed multiple therapies. And so it looked like it was efficacious, and it looked like it was otherwise safe. There was one case of herpes reactivation and one case where nephritis got worse. I wouldn't say that's out of the realm of expectation. So again, lupus skin disease can be refractory, and we've had recent reports suggesting this, and also suggesting, we reported before about a number of reports about anifrolumab being used in DLE. And then we also have some reports out there about maybe JAK inhibitors. That might be where they work too. But again, we don't have really positive trials with JAK inhibitors. We're waiting on more studies, including with deucravacitinib and the TYK2 inhibitor. Another study on lupus looked at the predictability of arthritis outcomes. In this particular study of 91 lupus patients who all had baseline ultrasound exams, they looked at the patients 10 years later. None of these patients had clinical synovitis by exam or swelling by exam, but on ultrasound, some of them had subclinical synovitis. 10 years later, the one-third who had progression of arthritis, and that's not really well described here, nonetheless, 75% of those people had evidence of baseline subclinical synovitis on ultrasound, suggesting a utility for using ultrasound routinely in practice. I don't use it unless I want to answer a question. And there, you know, I have some training, I have some ability here. There are some of you who use a lot of this, and I think that this data would support ongoing use. Interestingly, those people who did not have any worsening to arthritis or chronic arthritis, 77% did not have an abnormal ultrasound at baseline, which really means it's 25% who did. So therefore, what's the predictive value? It's probably pretty good, but it's not, you know, the negative predictive value is not 100% here. A study of almost 5,000 lupus patients classified them based on their hyperuricemia and what happened to uric acid. So 9%, a minority of patients, were uric acid overproducers. Remember this idea, overproducers versus under-excreters, and that should help guide therapy. Well, they actually did the work. 9% were overproducers. 61% were under-excreters. And then 23% were combined, and 7% were neither. So in the overproducers, the profile was they were older and had lower uric acid levels, and they had tophi and diabetes at baseline. Kind of interesting. And I found this more interesting, that the biggest group, the under-excreters, had lower BMIs, did not have diabetes. And there was no comment about renal function in their characterization. The combined ones were a bit of a mess. They were younger, higher BMI, high serum uric acids, lower GFRs, and they were smokers. So, okay, I think that this is somewhat of a myth buster for me, because I would assume that the under excreters are often on diuretics, often have some degree of CKD, but that wasn't borne out in this study. But maybe the ones that do have that are the ones who actually have some element of overproduction and under excretion. I like the study about maybe when you stop biologics in patients with systemic JIA, also known as Still's disease. This is an adult population, and they showed they had 48 patients, and they had 38 of those patients who were in remission after 6 months of tocilizumab. That's pretty good. You know, 75% or so of patients who go on tocilizumab in the study with adult Still's go into remission within 6 months. 12 of them discontinued the tocilizumab and half flared. So is there a lesson there? And the big question I get as a Still's expert is, when can you stop the biologic, either the IL-1 inhibitor or the IL-6 inhibitor, and I don't have a strong number, and there isn't a good strong number in research. This is an attempt at some data, but only, you know, a third of the patients who were in remission stopped their tocilizumab, and 50% had a flare rate. I wouldn't do it at 6 months if they were in remission. So this data kind of supports my shoot from the hip guidance, which says to my Stills patients, you show me 1 year of remission, meaning no systemic activity on whatever therapy, and then we start to withdraw therapy. And that's always worked well for me. I wonder what you do. Another study on tocilizumab comes from the Japanese. They studied 672 patients for receiving either TNF or tocilizumab, and they showed that 1.6% developed a non-tuberculous mycobacterial infection, NTM, what we used to call atypical mycobacterium. This includes MAC, MAI, etc. And that number was 9 patients total, I think. 2 had disseminated infection, 2 died. And so mortality was higher in these patients on biologics who did get NTM, 22% versus 2.6%. Such patients who died were also more likely to be on higher steroids, 17 milligrams versus 3 milligram of prednisone a day, and that's significant. So what's the lesson here? Number one, that the risk of developing non-tuberculous mycobacterial infections, we know, is high in people who take TNF inhibitors. I didn't know that it was high with tocilizumab, but again, if they're on tocilizumab and they're also on 17 milligrams of prednisone, it might be higher than the average population. I'm still going to assert the greatest risk for all mycobacterial infections, whether it's NTM or MTB, is highest and most serious in patients on TNF inhibitors. And as I think I mentioned last week or the week before, you can treat the TB infection and resume the TNF inhibitor. With the NTM, you can treat the NTM, but you can never resume the TNF inhibitor because they never fully eradicate it. It's like chronic invasive fungal infections. You can treat it, but it never eradicates, so going back on TNF inhibitor would not make sense. I do think the other take-home here is you do need to worry about non-tuberculous mycobacterial infections. They are 3 times more common than TB in immunosuppressed patients like ours than regular TB. And that's what you should worry about. 2 to 3 times higher based on past studies. I don't know if you worry about the future of rheumatology as I do and the manpower issue. It's a big issue. I keep, you know, worrying about it, reading about it, and seeing nothing done about it. Well, researchers at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, had a nice report this past week about their look at the U.S. workforce. And they showed that between 2009 and 2022, the rheumatology workforce grew on average 23%. Moreover, there's a higher percentage of women going into rheumatology. We know that to be true. During that same period, there was a 43% increase in the number of women in rheumatology. So previously, the number that was thrown out, the number of rheumatologists in the United States was about 4,999. And by this 2020 number, it grew by up to 5,667. That's a 23% growth for rheums. The number of APs also significantly increased, and it went up to 379 with a growth of 141. I can tell you, as I know APP numbers, and I think the real APP number in the United States who are practicing rheumatology or musculoskeletal medicine is over 1,500. But nonetheless, where they could track this stuff based on claims data and whatnot and who is, you know, coding for this, at least APPs have also gone up, and that's a very good trend and hopeful for you and I who are in the business and sometimes will leave the business. I don't know if you saw the report I posted about the Washington Post article, and it was a medical mystery, you know, sort of like a case report. It's sort of a human interest story about a woman who was a runner and a scientist, a bright, bright person, who basically have a 7-year saga of twisting her ankle would result in swelling and continued problems and inability to resume her running, and, you know, went to multiple family doctors, 3 or 4 physical therapists, two or three orthopedists, and finally one was going to do surgery on her to shorten up her ligaments. I don't know what that was going to do, but at least that orthopedist had the good sense to say, just as a prelude to surgery, get a rheumatologic evaluation. And lo and behold, one of our great colleagues in the DC area diagnosed the patient with enthesitis due to psoriatic arthritis, instituted therapy. At the end of the article, the patient saying, yeah, I was stubborn. She thought that it was good to work through the pain and that she was sort of nonchalant about her symptomatology, that she was probably going to the wrong people. And then she wondered, I wonder if I can get back into running. And in my experience, patients like this with enthesitis and psoriatic arthritis, they absolutely can get back into their former activity that they'd love to resume. But obviously, you have to control their disease, which is what that rheumatologist is going to do. Congratulations to all your rheumatologists and your wisdom. The question is, how are you going to get these people 7 years sooner? And my answer to the question is, we need to be more proactive. We need to advertise who we are, what we do. I know all of you will see anybody tomorrow when they call you saying, I think this lady has vasculitis or rheumatoid arthritis or whatever. Yeah, you'll work through lunch, you'll whatever, but they don't call you. They call you when they want to unload someone they don't know what to do with, which is usually fibromyalgia, not the serious diagnosis. So you should be advertising, I'm into early RA, early psoriatic arthritis, you know, lupus and whatever. Please send me your patients. I'll make sure they get in sooner. We need to be more proactive. So here's a group of studies that I think I'm a little concerned about. This is a study, a fairly well-done study, good size and whatnot, showed no selective treatment responses in RA patients based on seropositivity. Now, this is an analysis of 28 clinical trials, comes from a really good group in Europe, who showed that whether you that if you were either on conventional DMARDs or biologic DMARDs, seropositivity, mainly talked about rheumatoid factor here, did not predict better overall responses when you're looking at ACR20 responses. So they're using clinical trial data, which is probably the most accurate, is it not? And they pooled it all and used a really objective outcome for response in ACR20. And again, the relative risk was about 1 and not significantly different. And again, they showed no difference in RF and RF positive, RF negative, especially when you were treated with either a TNF inhibitor or non-TNF biologic. Now, this goes against what has been out there in selective trials, some of which are clinical trials, some of which are observational trials, where to me it seems like there's an advantage only for, if you're seropositive, that you're going to do better if you're treated with either rituximab or abatacept and maybe with a JAK inhibitor. That's what I kind of believe. This data, which is meta-analysis, kind of dispels that. What am I going to believe? I don't know. I think I need to see more data. In the meantime, I'm going to remain hopeful that if I can profile patients based on seropositivity to get an additional 10% advantage, that might color some of my prescriptions. But then again, you may want to believe this very well done study. I believe this is an ARD. So again, congratulations to those authors for digging up this data and taking a really good look at this. Another great study, the PEXIVAS study, as you know, is sort of a study of a large cohort of severe ANCA patients, and it has a 2x2 table of patients who are either treated with plasma exchange or treated with one of two different steroid dosing regimens. And in this study, they have 700 post hoc study of 704 patients, they found that 92% of patients achieved remission, 23% had a relapse. But that neither plasma exchange or steroid tapering regimen impacted the relapse risk. And that's somewhat sobering. Now, all these people were on background immunosuppression and whatnot, and they did have fairly good success with their remission rates and fairly low or moderately low relapse rates. But I think for many of us, when we see really bad ANCA vasculitis, we pull out all the stops. We get super aggressive on steroids. Maybe that's not necessary. We get super aggressive and institute plasma exchange at great cost. So I'm not sure what to do with this data. If I think I have a concern, I'm going to ask one of the vasculitis mavens, like Peter Merkel and Carol Langford and all the people at the Cleveland Clinic. And there's a whole bunch of you out there that are vasculitis mavens who can guide us. Recent reports from the ACR suggested that if you had alveolar hemorrhage, that there also wasn't a benefit to plasma exchange, although the data wasn't quite so clear, and it was a numeric trend that was not significant. So if I have alveolar hemorrhage, which in my opinion, my experience and the research shows has an incredibly high mortality rate, yeah, I'm going to still use plasma exchange. But again, we need more great studies. I don't think we're going to get many great studies like PEXIVAS. It took a number of years. It was a plenary session at the last two ACR meetings and whatnot. So, but this is a, you know, research that also comes from the naysayers. Infection and rituximab. Now, I also found this confusing. This is a single center French study of 311 patients. 10% of those patients had prevalent, going into the study, they had an immunoglobulin deficiency, and 20%, 19 point something percent, acquired an immunoglobulin deficiency. And overall, they had a severe hospitalizable infection rate of almost 15% during, I think it was over 4 years of follow-up. But that was unrelated to immunoglobulin levels and whether or not the patient had immunodeficiency. Instead, they wanted to make the case, as all of us know, and as I've pointed out here, that you're going to get severe infections based on severe comorbidities, especially chronic lung disease, high uses of steroids, and high disease activity. Those were the main drivers of SIE in patients receiving rituximab, and not immunoglobulin levels. So the question is, does this change thinking? You know, the people who developed rituximab had long-term follow-up studies on large cohorts of patients treated with up to 9 courses of rituximab, and they looked at, you know, low IgM, low IgG, low IgA, etc., and they found that if you had prevalent IgG deficiency or you developed an IgG deficiency as a result of rituximab therapy, you had a significant increase in serious infectious event rates. This data, one center, retrospective, only 311 patients. The other Genentech data, I think Mark Genovese and others were authors on that report. There was thousands of patients. I want to say 4,000 patients, or maybe it was 4,000 patient years. So anyway, I'm still going to worry about immunoglobulin. I'm still going to check immunoglobulin levels in patients who get repeated rituximab, and I'm going to worry about IgG deficiency and maybe even treat it if I'm going to continue to use rituximab. We're going to end with a report on CV risk appearing early in rheumatic disease diagnoses. Look at this registry data from the Finns, collecting data between 2000 and 2014, and they looked at many thousands of patients. I'm looking at almost, oh my goodness, 7,000 patients with seronegative, seropositive RA, AS, PSA, lupus, Sjogren's, and gout. And they basically showed, as you might expect, that all these inflammatory rheumatic and autoimmune conditions had a higher risk of cardiovascular disease, many different cardiovascular morbidities. The take-home point that was really kind of worrisome was that, well, first off, that it was highest in gout and lupus, right? Second, that for all of these, the risk was mainly within 1 year after the diagnosis that there was a peak incidence in cardiovascular events. But that for gout, and maybe even spondylitis, that the risk of cardiovascular events preceded the diagnosis. So you should actually look at this paper, and I think it's an ARD, and you can look at the graphics that show you the timeline on risk. It's really quite interesting. This all says that, you know, the risk of cardiovascular and vascular events as a consequence of chronic inflammation starts really early and may even precede the onset of disease. Maybe it's going on during that preclinical RA, preclinical lupus, preclinical gout even. My goodness. Anyway, I want to remind you that in the month of April, we're going to do some replays on Room Now Live. We're going to start by doing Tuesday night rheumatology sessions, webinars, 6:30 p.m. this April. We have 5 Tuesdays in April, and we're going to do them starting April 2nd, where we're going to review the RA session first on April 2nd, followed the next week by the psoriatic arthritis session, the spondyloarthritis after that, JAK inhibitors after that, and lupus after that. In those weeks, we have a lot of content that we generated during Room Now Live 2024 that took place in Dallas in late January. You'll be seeing that, so watch for that. I think you'll enjoy it. Thanks for tuning in. You go to the website to check out these citations and more. Tell your friends. Give us a good review. See you next week.